Okay, good evening, everyone, in person and on Zoom. So,
good evening, Rabbi.
I don't know if people are up to date on all the exciting, let's call it politics in the Jewish community these days, but this topic is actually very apropos. Because there is a, I don't know where it is, but there is a community where there actually is an active case of an aguna. Just so people know, make sure we're all on the same page. An aguna, in modern day terms, is typically used to refer to a woman who the husband refuses to give the get. And as such, she's sort of stuck. If she abides by Orthodox Jewish law, there is very little that can happen, and so she's chained in this marriage. And so there is a woman, I'm assuming somewhere down in New York, who is struggling with this right now with her ex-husband, or, you know, still halachic husband, but so she's struggling with it. And there are a whole there's a whole movement right now of women who are all refusing to go to the mikveh, who are saying that we're not going to go to the mikveh until this guy is pressured enough by enough of the husbands in the community to make sure that the get is given. And so it's really, really exciting. It's really exciting. Well, not, it's terrible, but it's interesting stuff going on right now. So all the more so that it's such a relevant topic. And so what we're going to do is basically twofold. The first is that we are going to try and understand how it is that we got here in terms of why is Judaism so harsh when it comes to marriage, such that if a couple wants to get out of it, that the woman is able to be in a situation like this, to be chained to a dead marriage. That's number one. Number two, we're going to try and see what solutions are out there in order to allow the woman to be freed from a marriage. We will touch on also the fact that this is not really only a women's issue. It could go the other way as well, but it is primarily, typically, usually one way. And lastly, we'll talk about some of the modern innovations that have been developed over the last few decades to really help and fix this issue once and for all to the best of our abilities. And then we'll give a final note at the end to talk about a teshuvah that is hot off the press, talking about the mikveh strikes. One of the gedolim in our community just came out with a comment on it literally a few hours ago, and so we'll talk about that as well. So if you take a look at source number one, if you look that way, so the Mishnah in Kiddushin tells us, oh, this is very hard, actually. This is going to be interesting. Okay, should I sit there tonight?
I think that's what? Where you...
I should just sit there, right? I'm gonna sit there. It'll be easier for we'll figure it out for next time.
Okay.
Wait, but now I need the microphone, right? Just imagine folks behind me. Okay, and action. Okay, so if you take a look at source number one, it's the very first Mishnah that we have in Masechet Kedushin, in which we are told just how marriage works in general. And so please be kind to me when it comes to this translation, because this is the typical translation, although it is not really A, PC, and B, even technically correct. But we'll read through the English slowly. So a woman is acquired, meaning she becomes betrothed to a man to be his wife in three different ways. She acquires herself, meaning she terminates her marriage, in two ways. The Mishnah elaborates that she is acquired through money, through a document, and through sexual intercourse, right? So these three things are how a couple typically is married. Halachically, nowadays we usually use money by way of a ring. And that is how a marriage takes place. And so in particular, though, what we are focusing on are the two ways in which she acquires herself back, in a sense, and that is through ultimately divorce is option A, and option B is death, right? So if the husband dies, then she gets herself back as well. And so that is the only way that a woman can get out of a marriage and how a woman can be married to someone else. We know that technically on a biblical level, a man is allowed to be married to multiple wives. However, we know because of something called Takanas Rabbeinu Gershom, that there is a concept that men are not allowed to have more than one wife as well nowadays. Such that if a man goes ahead and tries to marry a second woman, then any rabbi worth his weight in what's the phrase?
Salt. In gold.
Okay. Worth his weight in gold and or salt, will not marry him because that is not permissible. There are ways that a man could technically be married to a second woman, and that is with what's called a heter mea rabbanim, which literally translates into a basically, for all intents and purposes, let's call it a petition that a 100 rabbis will sign that agree to this reality that for whatever reason they are saying this man is allowed to be married to a second woman, and then he is good to go. Of course, the equivalent does not exist for a woman as well because of the fact that biblically she is not allowed to be married to more than one woman. Now,
one
man. Thank you. Okay, so let's take a look at source number two, and just to get more of a sense of the greater topic over here. So the Gemara in Yevamos tells us as follows. Trying to figure out where I want to start. You know what, let's just look at this last line over here in the Gemara. So the Gemara answers, due to the case of a deserted wife of an aguna, the sages were lenient with her. Since it is not always easy to find two witnesses to attest to a husband's death, the sages realized that if the testimony of one witness were not accepted, the woman would be likely to remain a deserted wife, unable to remarry. However, to prevent this leniency from causing mistakes and licentiousness, they were very stringent with her in a case where the testimony is found to be erroneous, to ensure that she is very careful not to accept untrustworthy accounts. Essentially, what this Gemara is telling us over here is that the rabbis have a general principle that when it comes to an aguna, the rabbis are incredibly lenient. Now, again, when the rabbis were talking about this in the times of the Gemara, it wasn't talking about these recalcitrant husbands who were not giving gets. It was rather a husband was lost at sea, or a husband could not be found, and so she was chained to a marriage for a different reason. And so with all of those cases, the rabbis were as lenient as possible, such that we would allow a woman to remarry based on the testimony of a single witness, which is typically not how we do things in halacha. Usually we use two witnesses, but when it comes to this situation, the rabbis were very lenient. With that as a foundation, so that should give us a general understanding of how the rabbis will then want to approach seemingly modern-day agunot. If they were lenient back then, thousands of years ago, for a situation that more often than not was probably less out of people's control. So for sure nowadays, they probably would be want to be lenient as well. Now, one of the tools that the rabbis used in the times of the Gemara is what's called afkinu dekdushin, which basically means that the rabbis have the right to uproot any marriage they want to. If you take a look in source number three, the Gemara in Ketubot tells us that it's within the authority of the sages to institute an ordinance freeing the woman from the marriage, as anyone who betroths a woman betroths her contingent upon the agreement of the sages. So, right, so every single time a couple gets married, a man says to a woman that hare at, and he finishes the line, and he says, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, that it's with the knowledge, with the agreement of Moshe and Israel, meaning the rabbis, that the rabbis have to accept it. And if the rabbis have to accept it, so, you know, I guess this did not age so well, but there's the line from the Cosby Show, right? That Bill Cosby said to his kids, you know, I brought you into this world, I could take you out of it, right? And then so the same thing when it comes to the rabbis, we allowed you to get married, we could take you out of the marriage. And that's what the Gemara is essentially saying over here. And so with this in mind, you would think quite simply that anytime a rabbi wants to uproot a marriage, he should be able to do so. There should never be such a thing as an aguna. But the truth is, though, that the rabbis were understandably very careful when it came to applying this rule, because that would lead to an understandable amount of chaos. If a rabbi could just uproot any marriage he wanted to at any point, that would not be something that would ultimately do the Jewish people well. One of the other tools that rabbis had used over time is what's called a mekach ta'ut. Anyone know what a mekach ta'ut is? So a mekach ta'ut literally translates into a mistaken sale. And in this context, what it means is that if there was something that was not communicated, either from the husband to the wife or from the wife to the husband, then about something about themselves, then the rabbis would say that the marriage is off. That it's basically, you can use like an annulment in a sense. And you didn't disclose this to her, she didn't disclose this to you, forget about it, it's like you're never married. And so the rabbis were often more likely to use these types of principles when it came to a woman not disclosing something to a man because of a principle, again, that did not age necessarily so well, but what's called tav lemesav tandu melemesav nisarmalu. What that means is that certainly back in the day, it was more often than not better for a woman to be married than to not be married. And so women had lower standards, perhaps, than men sometimes. And so as a result, they were not as, did not apply that principle as broadly for women as they did men. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, if someone is not disclosing something that is very important, then the rabbis do have the right to say that this is not a marriage that is allowed to stand, because they would not have gone into this marriage if not for X, Y, and Z. And so what I want to, we're not going to really read through them because there's a lot to read through, but what I want to present to you to make sure that you're aware of it, because you can't learn this topic without knowing about this, is that there are basically four landmark decisions, four landmark cases that took place with Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great halachic decider of the 20th century in America. And he ruled on four cases in which the man was the one. Is it the captions? Is that what's happening?
Yes.
Okay. Maurice, turn the captions. Turn the
yes.
captions off.
I'm laughing at you.
Do you need them?
No, I'm good.
Okay. All right, just turn them. it's okay. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, in four specific cases, basically said that this is a situation where we can assume that the woman never would have married the man because if she had known this, but as a result, and therefore as a result, we can just assume that the marriage is not real, and they don't have to stay married. She doesn't need a get from him. So what are these four cases? Anyone want to take a guess? What are some things that you would think that a woman would be so disgusted by in a man that she would say retroactively, had I known this, I would not have stayed married to you? Okay, good. Illegal activities, maybe. Sort of a wide spectrum of things. But then the truth is,
drugs, alcohol, immorality,
abuse.
Okay, good. Drugs, alcohol,
children,
immorality.
Hurting children.
Okay, good. So one area.
He's already married.
So, okay, good. All right. So one area that Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about is mental illness. And in particular, the case that he's talking about is a fascinating one, where there's a man who marries a woman and he has horrible social anxiety to the point that he literally cannot be outside and he cannot be in public at all. And so what happened was, however he married this woman, he ended up marrying her, but something triggered his mental illness, and he basically went back to his parents' house and he locked himself in, and for a significant period of time he would not come out. So therefore, A, she could not have a marriage with this man, but B, she couldn't even get a get from him because he literally would not walk out the door or wouldn't even allow himself to be seen by anyone. So that was one example in which Rav Moshe Feinstein said that it's clear that this was an illness that he had from before the marriage, and this woman was not made aware of it at all, and therefore we can assume this is a mekach ta'ut and just nullify the marriage entirely. It's important.
What time would
What year would that be, like Moshe Feinstein?
This was in the 1900s.
1900s.
Yeah. Okay, 1950s, 1960s, okay. That time. So that was case number one. Now, it's important to also recognize that we're only always going to be talking about a pre-existing condition, right? Because if it's something that a person developed later on in life, then unfortunately, you marry a person no matter who they are, and so if they happen to develop an illness that they have no proof existed beforehand, then it doesn't apply. In this specific case number one of talking about a mental illness, it was clear he just totally did not tell the woman beforehand. And so that's why Rav Moshe Feinstein said over here, they do not need to stay married. So that's case number one. Case number two is where the woman had no idea that her husband was gay. And not knowing that her husband was gay is obviously would have been a tremendous red flag, because he could not be with her. He had no attraction to her. He had no interest in being connected with her. And so therefore, as a result, said Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you can prove that he was gay beforehand, which nowadays is probably a lot easier than it was, even 20 years ago, with social media or things like that. If you can prove it, that he was gay, then you can go ahead and annul this marriage. Case number three was actually a case of impotence, that the man was totally unable to have marital relations with his wife, and therefore, as a result, Rav Moshe Feinstein annulled that marriage. And the last case was one of a meshumad, someone who totally left Judaism, and he had left Judaism and he had started following other religions or whatever way before they had even gotten married, and he was basically putting on an act when he was dating his wife, and then all of a sudden, what do you know? He's not at all connected to Judaism whatsoever. And so does a person who assumed that they were marrying someone who was deeply connected to Judaism and really turns out was not, are you forced to stay married to that person? Because you could understand that obviously someone like that, which happens all the time, probably does not care that much about giving a get, right? And so are you allowed to get out of that marriage without a get? Rav Moshe Feinstein ended up ruling again in that case that you can assume that that's also a mekach taot, and you can get out of that marriage. All of these cases, what is that? Oh gosh. All of these cases have two important elements in common. Number one, as we said before, it has to be a pre-existing condition. And number two, this is like the worst case scenario. If you have someone who is any of these things, gay, impotent, connected to another religion, has severe mental health issues, any of these situations for whatever reason, they are unable to give a get, or they are not willing to give a get, I guess you could say, that's when you could be lenient. But if one of these individuals is willing to give the get, then that's the ideal, because it's the much more clear cut path of how to deal with the issue. So it's only when the person is unwilling, then what do you do? And that's where these cases came in. Is there a hand? No? Okay. Yeah? No?
So I guess some of the questions arise by, if you find out after getting married, and the person presumably did not show anything prior to that, then what are your options?
Okay, right, exactly. And that's really where most of the question becomes, what is a person to do? How do you get out of a marriage like that? And in that circumstance, that's really where your options are sort of limited, right? Death or a get? That's really it.
Threatened,
and then
threatened in any way?
What do you mean?
Well, if the person ends up being abusive, or
right,
it wasn't a category.
It's not one of those categories.
Yeah. So listen. When it comes to someone who's abusive, so typically people are repeat offenders, right? So it doesn't mean you always have proof, but typically anyone who was abusive in this relationship likely was abusive in previous relationships. So if you could prove something like that, you may have much more to go on.
But if you can't,
there's not much that you could do, because the guy would claim even if he admits to being abusive, which typically abusive people do not admit to being abusive, but even if he did, so he could just claim that it started from after the marriage. You make me abusive, right? And so therefore, that's not something that unfortunately could be easily utilized. Now, we're going to jump around a little bit. I want to show you this source over here, source number 5. It's a piece from Rabbi Soloveitchik because it's really important. So we mentioned before that there is something called the Heter Mea Rabbanim, that if you have a man who wants to marry another wife, and a second wife, so you can get this petition signed by 100 rabbis and you'd be good to go. Now, unfortunately, this is used to this day when you have an individual who wants to go ahead and not give his wife a get, and so but he's still a quote-unquote from guy, so he knows he can't marry a second woman, but if he can get a Heter Mea Rabbanim, so he can not give her a get, and now he's permitted to marry someone else. What a lovely class act. There are some rabbis who, in principle, will never sign a Heter Mea Rabbanim. Not that there has never been a case in Jewish history where it made sense for there to be one, but because of it's just so bad to allow a man to be married to two women, it's not even worth getting into. So Rabbi Soloveitchik writes that in source number 5, he says as follows: I will reveal a secret to you, my friend. In my entire life, I have never signed a Heter Mea Rabbanim, even in cases where the halachic foundation for it is sound. An American Jew will understand that the halacha demands, in instances where there is no halachic divorce, that it is impossible to marry or be married. One fate is shared by husband and wife. However, he can under no circumstances understand that the wife must remain chained single while the husband, in a similar situation, can marry another woman in addition to his wife and live happily with her. Right? So Rabbi Soloveitchik was so disgusted by this reality that some men would actually try and utilize this to marry a second woman and be totally content with that other woman being in a state of singlehood, right? But while being chained to a marriage for the rest of her life. And so Rabbi Soloveitchik was very anti this. Now, what that does create, just, you know, to be equal opportunists over here to the best of our abilities, so what that does create, of course, is when you do have a really, really bad woman, and you have a really, really great guy, so you could have a woman refuse to accept a get. And if the woman refuses to accept a get, so you could have not an agunad, an agun, right, who is a man who is not able to get remarried. And so that's where it gets a little tricky. And many of these batei din that are going out and allowing these men to receive a heter mea rabbanim, they're, you know, trying to pull at people's heartstrings and say, this poor guy, you know, this woman did this to him, did that to him, you know, let him get remarried. Whereas, of course, nine times out of ten, these are just, you know, some corrupt batei din who are allowing this to take place. But again, there is, you know, one in a million, it does happen, where some really nice guy does get messed over because of all the other terrible guys out there. But that was Rabbi Soloveitchik's rule. He never signed a Heter Mea Rabbanim. Now, if we take a look at... So if we take a look at source number 6 over here, so there are a few sources that are really important to get a sense of in terms of the fact that we are never allowed to force a get, right? The fact that it has to be given by someone's free will, that is a complex area of halacha. So if you take a look over here in source number 6, the Gemara in Yevamot will read the Hebrew and translate, Eino dome ha'ish ha'megaresh la'isha ha'mitgareshet, sha'isha yotza lertzona v'shalo lertzona. Right, so the Gemara basically presents to us the following reality over here. Technically, now this was back in the day, there was at one point a time where a man was able to divorce a woman without her consent. He could just throw a get at her and say, Bye-bye, honey. Right? And so that was undone by the rabbis because of another tzakana that was made, because of another rabbinic decree. The rabbi said, that's not fair. And so you can't divorce someone against their will on either side of the aisle. That's number one. And number two, at the end of the day, you need to have these two willing parties who are either they want to stay married or they both want to get divorced. Then everyone has to be on that same page, which raises this question of being able to force a man to give a get, right? So again, the woman doesn't have a choice. On a biblical level, she is forced to stay in the marriage. If she is someone who cares about the halacha, then she has no other options. There's really very, very few options for her. So what if we can just go out and get this man to give a get? You know, there's lots of different tactics out there to be used to get the man to give a get. So would that be allowed? So if you take a look at source number 7, Rav Nachman said that this is not difficult, as in this case, the Mishnah discusses someone who is forced to divorce his wife by verbal means alone. But in that case, it is referring to compelling him by beating him with rods. Although the court does compel a man to divorce his wife if she has not had children, the court does so only by speaking with him. And Rabbi Abba strongly objects to this. Can there be a halacha of coercion by verbal means alone? But the verse states, a servant will not be corrected by words. Rather, Rabbi Abba said, both this and that are referring to coercion by beating him with rods. But there, with regard to the blemishes specified in the Mishnah, if she says, I want to be with him, we leave her alone with him and do not force a divorce. Whereas here, in the case of a woman who has not given birth, even though she says, I want to be with him, we do not leave her alone as her husband is neglecting the mitzvah to be fruitful and multiply. Okay, all right, so essentially what the Gemara is grappling with over here is trying to figure out to what extent we force someone to divorce the other one when you have one partner who says, I still want to be in this, and another partner who says, I don't want to be in this. So when can we force, when can we not force? And that is what the Gemara is struggling with. So there was, of course, a lot of interesting things that have happened over the last few decades of cases just dealing with this issue over here of people who try to force men to give gets, and it does not come off very well in the headlines of the newspapers when you hear about these situations. And so there was a rabbi they called the Prod Father in source number 8. And it's an article basically about I'll let the article speak for itself. A New Jersey rabbi who ran a ring that violently attempted to coerce Jewish men to grant their wives religious divorces has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Right? So first of all, if we pause right here, the guy had really good intentions. It's not the best thing in the world to torture people, but you know, it's not like these men were angels, right? They were refusing to give their wives gets. They were abusing their wives. Okay. Rabbi Mendel Epstein, 70, was sentenced Tuesday in federal court in Trenton, New Jersey. And Epstein was one of 9 people, 2 of them rabbis, convicted for their roles in the ring, which for a fee, that's where it doesn't look so good, kidnapped and tortured recalcitrant husbands with cattle prods and other weapons. According to halacha, or Jewish law, a Jewish woman cannot remarry without receiving a Jewish divorce or get from her husband. The women who are trapped in such marriages are called agunot, or chained women. The group's members were busted in an FBI sting operation. Epstein... Right, this is what the FBI is doing. Epstein, a prominent rabbi in Lakewood, received the most jail time meted out thus far. The Daily News dubbed him the Prod Father. Okay. All right. It's a lovely story over here. Right. And so what you have. Yeah.
There was someone in Rochester who told Jordan Appelay that he would help force men.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to really blame these people. I mean, when you...
But isn't there other things that they do, like putting pressure on their business or that kind
of thing? Oh, yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that in a moment. But
yeah,
listen...
But there are some cases where the man...
So I'll tell you. So there's an organization called ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. They have college students volunteering with them. So I did a lot of volunteer stuff with them when I was in NYU. And one of the things they do is they rally outside of people's homes. That's one method they use. But listen, What's more persuasive? A group of loud college students yelling, which is annoying and it does work, don't get me wrong, or some guy putting someone else tied up in the back of a truck and using, one option is a little bit more persuasive than the other. Not recommended, I'm not endorsing it, but again, you see enough sick people out there who do this over and over again, which there are. It's such a horrible issue and such a terrible distortion of Torah. That's really the worst part about this. That when it comes to Torah law, so we can have a separate conversation as to why the Torah made the system like this, right? People will call it sexist or really anti-women. You can call it whatever you want, but we believe in the divinity of the Torah, and we believe that the Torah and Hashem wanted it to be this way. And so when someone gets up and totally distorts the Torah and Halacha, which, as we know, the Torah is supposed to be, its ways are supposed to be of kindness and of peace. And so someone who gets up and is abusing someone because of a halacha, it's such a disgusting act. And so for someone else to get up and say, okay, listen, get in the back of my truck, we're going to take care of you and show you what disgusting is. So it's hard to not empathize. Yeah.
So here's the thing. That's one of Rabbi Feinstein's things. He's not following halacha. He's not interested in Judaism. He's not doing exactly what one of those four things are.
Okay, so it's a good question. The problem is, though, that often what you have is a guy who is, for all intents and purposes, a regular religious dude. He is happy to go about his...
He's
what we call a 612er. He keeps all of the mitzvot except for that one. But again, pre-existing? No. If you would have asked him when he was a kid, most people, they call them ma'agim. Most ma'agnim, when they're like 10 years old, don't say, one day I'm going to withhold a get. Right? That's usually, it's what happens is a couple has a really difficult, rough marriage, often because of two parties, right? It takes two to tango. But unfortunately, one of them halachically has the upper hand, and he decides to hold that against the other person. And so that's not pre-existing. It's usually, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Withholding a get just for the sake of withholding a get or for is abusive. I would think that anyone who is considering helping the aguna by putting pressure on the man, be sure that it is truly that abusive situation rather than desire to stay in the marriage.
Yeah, 100%. All right. What makes these cases so much more complicated? And you know, certainly it was when I was in college, and certainly when I first got involved. So everything at the very beginning seems very black and white. But the more you learn about cases, again, it's never okay to do this. But the more you learn about cases, you see that there are many, many layers. And it's not like, again, most people don't wake up one day and say, I'm going to fulfill my lifelong dream of abusing my wife. That's usually not what people aspire to. And so how someone ends up in this situation is quite complex. And you're correct that ultimately, for example, with these the prod father people, right? So if someone is paying you a fee, if it's a business to do this, that, you know, all of a sudden you become a little bit less, you ask less questions as long as the check clears, you know? And so it becomes very, very complicated. Yeah. Okay. So what I want to do is show you this Rambam. The Rambam has a really important piece over here. He was a big supporter of the Prod Fathers. He says as follows. When a man whom the law requires to be compelled to divorce his wife does not desire to divorce her, the court should have him beaten until he consents, at which time they should have a get written, and the get is acceptable. This applies at all times and in all places. Similarly, if Gentiles beat him while telling him, do what the Jews are telling you to do, and the Jews have the Gentiles apply pressure on him until he consents to divorce his wife, the divorce is acceptable. If, however, the Gentiles compel him to write a get on their own initiative, the get is merely unacceptable. The rationale is that the law requires him to give a divorce. Why is this get not void? So this is the big question we have to ask ourselves. Why do we say that the get is kosher if he's being forced to do so, right? As a general rule, we believe that someone has to do it with their own free will. So this is the best line. For he is being compelled either by Jews or by Gentiles to divorce against his will, and the get must be given voluntarily. Because the concept of being compelled against one's will applies only when speaking about a person who is being compelled and forced to do something that the Torah does not obligate him to do. Meaning that a person who was beaten until he consented to a sale or to give a present. If, however, a person's evil inclination presses him to negate the observance of a mitzvah or to commit a transgression, and he was beaten until he performed the action he was obligated to perform, or he disassociated himself from the forbidden action, he is not considered to have been forced against his will, right? On the contrary, it is he himself who is forcing his own conduct to become debased, right? So basically what the Rambam is saying really beautifully over here, that someone who isn't giving a get to their wife, so that person is following the Yetzer Hara, right? He's a sinner. And so we don't like to support sinners. We like to help them see the light. So we can really help them see the light with a couple of knocks in the head. And they'll really see the light that way. And so that was the Rambam's perspective. And again, it was a really important one. I am seeing now that my computer might die, so we're going to finish this up quickly. Okay, so that's the Rambam being very pro beating men. But again, for many reasons nowadays, this is not something that we do approve of. No one should walk away from this saying that Rabbi Winston is pro this. But it was certainly a perspective out there that was followed and was accepted at one point. The Shulchan Aruch has this long, lengthy discussion in terms of giving a psak of what we do and don't do. And basically, when it comes down to it, the difficulty is that, again, the man has to be able to give the get fully of his own free will, and if he is not giving it of his own free will, then it's not going to be an acceptable get. What this really leads us to, and again, I apologize for rushing through the end over here, I just don't want my computer to die, is that we need to be able to find a way to preempt this whole issue. And that's where what we call the halachic prenup comes in. This is something that is a really important document, and they even have halachic postnups as well. And I always tell people if you got married before the prenup existed, or if you didn't get the prenup when you first got married, that you should get the postnup. And what it basically is that it's a document that one way, shape, or form will encourage a husband who is trying to withhold a get to not be able to withhold the get. The simple way that works according to halacha is as follows. We know that as a general rule, a man is obligated to support his wife. How do we know that a man is obligated to support his wife? Right, the ketubah says it essentially. The ketubah says that the man has an obligation to support her. So essentially, and again, this is oversimplifying just because we're now short on time, but the halachic prenup is basically a legal way of ensuring that the husband will continue to support his wife until they decide to part ways. If the husband decides to try not to part ways by not giving her the get, that's fine. He just has to continue to support her until he decides that he's going to be finished. And so it's up to him. And so more often than not, when it has been tried in court, a couple that had signed the halachic prenup and then the husband tried to withhold the get, I believe almost, if not 100%, maybe 99.9% of the time, the document is upheld in court and the husband is basically told, okay, you signed a document before the marriage when you were actually still in love with your wife, when you cared about her, and it was that you were going to continue to take care of her no matter what. And now that you are not ending this marriage because you're not giving the get, that's fine, but you have to pay, $200 a day until, so if the guy is very wealthy, it doesn't work so well. But if the guy is not super wealthy or, whatever it is, then it's upheld very well. And so, I believe, if not in all cases, most cases that it has been tried, it has been something that has worked. Now, unfortunately, this document is only really a band-aid for the issue, because at the end of the day, we still have to grapple with the fact that a couple that either did not sign a prenup or, whatever it might be, a husband might still try to withhold the get in. This is obviously still an issue that we have to contend with. And that's where these other organizations and the like come in, not the ones that are cattle prodding people, but the ones that are protesting and things like that, trying to not force, because again, a forced get will not be something that we would accept for halacha, but trying to coerce in as peaceful a way as possible. Encourage, that's right. So whether it's with, you know, protests outside of their homes, protests by their places of work. My Rebbe Rav Willig likes to tell the story, or I don't know if he likes it, but he tells the story that there was once a ma'agin in his community in Riverdale, and all of the rabbis, to their credit, got together and said, we are not going to allow this guy to daven in any one of our shuls. And so what happened? This guy came for minyan and at Rav Willig's shul, and he stopped the service in the shul. He said, he got up there in front of everyone and said, we're going to have to wait for so-and-so to leave because he is not permitted to daven in our shul because he's not giving his wife a get. And okay, so eventually, the guy had to leave. What is he going to do? He tried to go to another shul, the same thing over and over again. And then the best part of the story is what happens afterwards, because eventually the guy realized he had to give his wife a get. So he gave his wife a get. And then he comes to Minyan a few days later and someone says, you know, Rav Willig, are we allowed to give him an aliyah? He said, why not? Yesterday he was a terrible sinner. Today he's a Baal Tshuva. So let him go and let him get an aliyah. And so that's exactly what happened, right? Again, in Judaism, we believe that people could make terrible decisions and make horrible mistakes. But if someone clearly atones for their sins, which this guy did, so we absolutely should allow for that sort of leeway. Ultimately, though, this does lead us to the final question that we started off with, which is, to what extent do we allow communal pressure to be an acceptable practice? And in particular, when it comes to large swaths of women deciding that none of them are going to go to the mikveh, is that something that's allowed? And so Rav Schechter from YU, he basically he wrote a psak today in which he basically said as follows. If in very, very limited circumstances, very limited, if a few women withholding this, deciding not to go to a mikvah, will ultimately lead to this guy successfully being able to give a get, that is something that, on a very, very small scale, perhaps could be permissible. However, what seems to be going on now is that this is something that's happening in mass, that there are, I don't know, hundreds, maybe thousands of women who are saying they heard about this case, and they're all saying they're not going to the mikvah. He said, it's very nice to be in solidarity with someone, but to use that as a weapon against your own spouse who may have very little to do with that person just to, you know, make a point, that seems to be something that is not super acceptable. And so ultimately, again, if you are in a situation where, you know, you have a group of three or four friends and one of the guys is a bum and he's not giving his wife a get, then okay, for those three wives to do something, that may be acceptable. But in the scale with what's happening now, seems to not be something that is so great. Ultimately, though, as a point of conclusion, we genuinely believe and feel quite strongly that our Torah is every single law in the Torah, every single mitzvah in the Torah is meant to convey a sense of beauty, of kindness. Oh, there goes my computer. Can they still hear me?
Yes, because okay. You plug into my computer.
Okay, great. So I'm going to keep talking, people on Zoom, even though you can't see me. We ultimately do believe that the Torah is all about kindness and love, and that even the mitzvot that seem to have not... that do not continue to look as great from a 2024 standpoint, let's say, because of horrible people who are trying to distort it, doesn't take away from the fact that the Torah is ultimately a beautiful text and a beautiful way of life. And so it's incumbent upon each and every one of us to do what we can to make sure that we are living up to the beauty of the standards of the Torah, and not destroying it like some people do. And so it's our responsibility if we, God forbid, ever find ourselves in a, whether directly or tangentially connected to something like this, to take a part in trying to help the situation come to a conclusion, and ultimately to realize that one should never throw out the baby with the bathwater, meaning that if you have one bad seed, one bad guy who's clearly distorting the Torah, doesn't mean the whole Torah is bad, it's just that this one guy is a horrible human being. And so with that, happy to take any questions, but otherwise wish everyone a beautiful night.
Question. Yeah. So,